Today's Between the Rows podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Gowan Canada, the go-to company. Gowan's herbicide portfolio includes Avidex and Fortress, which control Group 1 and Group 2 resistant wild oats. Don't let wild oats rob your yields. Use Avidex and Fortress to stop them in their tracks. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Lisa Gunther of Country Guide brings us advice on managing employees on your farm.
There are some red flags to watch for, and one is not being able to keep staff. And the common line you'll hear there is that the staff don't have a good work ethic. But if you can't keep staff, you're the common denominator, she says.
Jade Marcus from Commodity News Service Canada reports from a big American ethanol conference.
Trump is going to renegotiate deals that are beneficial for America and not really make any concessions.
And the Western producer's Darce McMillan takes a look at the markets.
The government in India doesn't want a whole bunch of pulse imports coming in at a time when Indian farmers themselves are harvesting a big crop. They don't want the price to fall too far because Indian farmers make up a big part of the political constituency there.
All this on Between the Rows with this week's host, Ed White.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. Do you know any human resources managers? Well, if you operate a farm with any workers or even just have a single hired hand, you already are one. First up on today's show, we're going to speak with Lisa Gunther, who looked into the tricky issue of HR and farming for Country Guide magazine. Hi, Lisa, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Ed.
Lisa, you spoke with an advisor who compared the state of today's farm HR with the way farmers used to do accounting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I talked to Leah Nibbs, who owns an HR firm in Weyburn. And she pointed out that farm accounting used to look like a shoebox full of bills and receipts to accountants. But farmers gradually adopted more sophisticated systems as they saw the returns that those systems produced. So Nibbs says that HR is undergoing the same evolution today.
Why do farmers need to define jobs on the farm, and why do they even need to write out maybe job descriptions?
Yeah, well, the reality is that farm families, just like other families, are getting smaller and smaller. So that means it's harder to find farm kids to hire. If you have a new employee who might not even have a farm background, how do you make sure that they know what their job is? I spoke with Tracy Bernacki-Duza with the Canadian Agricultural Human Resources Council. Last year, she and her colleagues sat down with producers to come up with job descriptions for 11 different commodities.
And then they go, but why do we have like four roles? And I said, well, they go, I do all this. And I said, I realize you are the entry experience supervisor and manager at a great deal of time, you know. But I said, if we could just pretend that you had a big enough operation that you would have had to have these different roles, because then it's easier when you're creating those kind of roles to make sure that there are actual delineations into what are you expecting an entry-level, the tasks that an entry-level person would be doing.
A lot of long-term farm workers become almost members of the family, which is something that a lot of farmers are very, very proud of. But are there dangers to that type of familiarity on the farm?
Yeah, Tracy said there does need to be some formality in the employee-employer relationship. Having written job descriptions can go a long way to helping everyone avoid surprises, for example. And if farms have both family and non-family employees, good HR practices can help avoid perceptions of unfairness. As Leah said, relationships with camaraderie are wonderful, but you don't want that camaraderie to get in the way of good business.
Now, how do you go about figuring out whether you're an adequate, a good, or an incompetent HR manager?
Well, there are some red flags to watch for, and Leah outlined three red flags. One is not being able to keep staff, and the common line you'll hear there is that the staff don't have a good work ethic. But if you can't keep staff, you're the common denominator, she says. Another red flag is losing sleep at night because you're worried about staff issues, Leah says.
They've got something in their belly that's working on them, And normally now we're talking about performance. There's something about performance, and they don't know how to address it.
And finally, if you find yourself wondering whether you're meeting employment standards like health and safety, you likely have a problem. Farmers aren't the only employers to have those challenges, though. In fact, Leah says if you're wondering what can go wrong, you can just look to some rural municipalities.
A few RMs have got caught with their pants down, and they are dealing with human rights issues, termination issues, all those kinds of things.
Well, I think dealing with a human rights violation is nothing that any farmer would want to deal with. They might not realize they're facing. So how does a farmer go from realizing they might have a problem to actually learning how to manage it better on their own farm?
Yeah, so I mean, some farms can justify hiring a foreman or contracting an HR firm, but they're still going to have to deal with the day-to-day HR stuff. But there are quite a few resources out there. So, for example, the Canadian Ag HR Council has quite a few online resources. One of those is an HR toolkit that covers everything from hiring to health and safety regulations to succession planning. They've also created a national ag job board at retail.agrijobmatch.ca. Another option is to hire a consultant to work with you. Leah says a good HR consultant will make sure the farmer knows about HR by the end of the process. And Leah and her colleagues have been working on an HR boot camp as well, so people come away with just the basic skills. Another suggestion from Leah was that farmers could create their own HR peer group, similar to other peer groups that focus on benchmarking costs, for example. So I think the bottom line is that there are resources out there. And as Leah pointed out, farmers have already upped their game in everything from accounting to agronomy. So they can definitely do that with HR.
So now the farmers are done with getting rid of those shoe boxes for accounting. They can move on to another type of improvement of management on the farm, I guess. Thank you very much for joining us today, Lisa.
Thanks, Ed.
Lisa Gunther is field editor for Country Guide magazine. And if you want to know more about her story and this issue, go and look at the magazine itself or go online to look at the Country Guide website. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host, Ed White. Coming up later, Darce McMillan on markets. But first, Commodity News Service reporter Jade Marcus was just down in San Diego, California, covering the National Ethanol Conference. She's joining us to provide a sense of how U.S. farm leaders and the ethanol industry are feeling in these early days of the Trump era. Hi, Jade, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jade, how are farmers feeling about the state of U.S. farm economy right now?
Not great. People are struggling with low commodity prices, and they saw low income last year. There's an element of apprehension with the new administration, but at the same time, there's a sense of, how do we fix this? How do we return to a more profitable place? And they're kind of looking to trade as sort of that saving grace.
Considering that you were at an ethanol conference, how is the ethanol industry feeling?
The ethanol industry is feeling pretty good. They had a solid year last year, and they're poised for pretty good growth this year. There's weak corn prices and strong demand. But at the same time, there are some shifts in key markets that they're kind of watching for. China is always a wild card. There could be some changes to their target price program, and there's some uncertainty about what trade with that market will look like moving forward. Brazil is expected to provide some pretty strong demand as well. They're more likely to produce sugar this year, so that could always change with price fluctuations, but they're supposed to be pretty good.
And this is obviously a time of great political change, to say the least. What were people saying about the possible impact that the new Trump administration might have on U.S. agriculture policy and on the ethanol industry?
Yeah, it was a pretty big focus. I think that there was a sense of optimism, but there was also a sense of uncertainty at the same time in both of the sectors. Donald Trump has made it pretty clear he wants to overhaul regulations. He hasn't specifically mentioned ethanol or agriculture, but officials seem to hope or think that by extension, some of that will apply to them. One of the big regulatory priorities for the ethanol industry is RVP parity, so officials there are kind of watching to see if that will come to fruition. The agriculture industry is looking to the next farm bill. Current one is set to expire next year, so farmers are kind of watching to see what kind of commodity price supports could potentially come out of that as talks and negotiations continue. Trade under the new administration was a big one that generated some mixed opinions. Those kind of looking on the bright side were of the opinion that Trump is going to renegotiate deals that are beneficial for America and not really make any concessions. But on the other hand, he's backed out of huge multilateral trade deals, which is a threat to those industries as well.
Trade's a really big issue, but it affects people on a very personal level, both good and bad. And what do people say to you about that?
I think that there is a lot of optimism in the farm community. On a micro level, I think that Trump really got into office because he was appealing to this America First. We're going to help these people who are struggling financially. So there is optimism when it comes to that. But then on the bigger scale, it is difficult with trade relations, and you have to account for these other countries that have their best interests in mind. So it'll be interesting to see moving forward how that kind of pans out, this America First priority, but on an international scale.
Was it the kind of thing people were having conversations about at coffee breaks?
Yeah. And especially the financial issues and how in rural areas people are really big on Donald Trump because he did appeal to that, and he understood something that I guess other people didn't.
Was there any talk at the conference about Canada?
Yeah, from the U.S. side of things, there was a fair bit of talk about Canada as a trade partner and the implications that renegotiating NAFTA could have. Canada is a pretty strong, steady market for ethanol, so they seem pretty keen to avoid trade conflicts with us. In terms of agriculture, I think growing U.S. commodity prices was a big part of the discussions, and to an extent that has an effect on Canadian prices. So by association, the moves or strides that they take there with profitability could affect Canada or Canadian markets.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Jade, and thanks for filling us in on that pretty interesting conference.
Thanks.
Jade Marcus is a reporter for Commodity News Service. Now, for insight into the crop markets, Darce McMillan, the Western Producers Markets Editor, is joining us. Hi, Darce. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ed.
Darce, a lot of farmers are worried about Canada losing access to India for pulse crops over a fumigation issue. What is the situation right now?
Yeah, well, it's a troubling situation because, of course, as you know, Ed, India is our biggest single pulse destination for pulse crops. So anyways, right now, maybe I should just give you a bit of a recap. India's had a long-standing rule to fumigate with methyl bromide at the point of export. The reason why they want this is they don't want to accidentally bring in a nematode pest in soil that could be mixed in with crops that are imported. And the nematode that they've identified is a threat apparently to their onion industry, and onions are a really big deal actually in India. So anyways, this has been around for, this just didn't come up, it's been around for many years, and for many years Canada has had an exemption from that rule, and the exemption allows any shipments out of Canada, any pulse shipments out of Canada, to be fumigated instead of being here in Canada. They're fumigated once they arrive in India. But now this year, India has had an excellent monsoon, and so they are looking at a big crop coming. And so this has given them some wiggle room to start to focus more back on this issue with methyl bromide, and because they're just tired, I guess, of doing all the fumigating in India. And they got, you know, before they were in, it was beggars can't be choosers. They had a need for pulse crops to come in, so they were willing to give Canada this exemption. But now they got a big crop themselves, so they're taking a somewhat tougher stance.
And I understand that we're facing a March 31st deadline, which is pretty soon.
Yeah, that's when this exemption expires. And it seemed leading up to this that the Indians weren't prepared to make any allowances. So if that was the case, then from that point of March First, if Canada wanted to ship something to India, we'd probably have to get it fumigated in a third country because we can't really do it here ourselves. Fumigation, first of all, doesn't really work well in the cold of winter here. And also here in Canada, we're phasing out the use of methyl bromide because it hurts the ozone layer. But kind of the latest, getting back to your original question, what's the situation right now? I did see a press report from India on February the 25th, on Friday, and that said that maybe something could be worked out depending on India's production and their import data. And I think the fact that they're looking at their production issue rather than science or something like that, I think this really highlights that this fumigation issue is more of a tool that they want to use to limit the imports of pulses in a period that Indian farmers are harvesting their winter crop. Domestic prices in India of pulses are way down from this time last year. Domestic production in India had been hit really hard by 2 years of below normal monsoons. So anyways, the government in India doesn't want a whole bunch of pulse imports coming in at a time when Indian farmers themselves are harvesting a big crop. They don't want the price to fall too far because that would anger their farmers in India. And, of course, Indian farmers make up a big part of the political constituency there. Still, though, they will need some pulse imports. They aren't completely self-sufficient. And an expert on the pulse situation in India recently wrote in a column in a newspaper there that said that the consumption of pulses had been limited for the last couple of years because of the high prices and low farm incomes, but now that prices have fallen because of the better crops that they're starting to see and because farmers have better incomes because of the better monsoon this past year. It's allowed the poor peasant farmers to actually have more money to buy more food. And so actually there might be a larger demand for pulses than there has been for the past 2 years.
Yeah, so if we can rebuild demand there just through these lower prices and higher incomes, maybe that will mitigate a bit of what could seem to certain pulse growers as a real nightmare scenario.
Yeah, well, you know, it does. We have to really just see what happens with this fumigation issue. It just so happens that this week, Canada's Agriculture Minister, Lawrence McAuley, is in India. He's there for a trade mission. So a lot of times, things seem to get worked out when a politician is visiting. You might remember that Trudeau was over in China, I think, earlier this year, and they managed to resolve an issue over canola dockage. Also, you know, the last quarter of the crop year is often a bit slow for pulse exports in India anyways, because they are harvesting their own crop. I think Canadian pulses will go to India in 2017, but maybe not in the quantity or perhaps the price that we saw in the past couple of years. But then again, those were pretty exceptional years.
As you said before, India is looking right now at a pretty good winter crop, at least to this point. And all around the world, we keep hearing reports of relatively good crop growing weather. What does that mean for the markets?
Yeah. Every news report I see about, you know, every daily report out of the Chicago markets and stuff, all the comments are about, gee, the weather is good in Brazil and Argentina and around the world. In fact, the forecasts for Brazil's soybean crop are rising to new record highs. Just today, Oil World put their forecast for the soybean crop in Brazil at 105 million tons. I think that's up about 9.5 million tons from last year. Argentina had some problems earlier on, but things are looking a lot better now. And so all that's weighing on soybean futures prices. And, of course, anytime soybeans are under pressure, almost always, canola futures are also under pressure. Now, the saving grace for canola is that our exports and domestic crush, they've really been exceeding expectations. So that should lead to a tightening of stocks as we get towards the end of our crop year.
In that situation, then, should we be expecting pretty good basis rates going forward?
Yeah. Tight supplies usually mean that grain companies and other buyers of crops have to make their basis more attractive for farmers to pry those last bushels out of their hands. But actually, at least right now, anyways, the basis is not cooperating in the favor of farmers. Basis on canola is more than $30 under the futures. That's a lot wider than it was last year at this time.
And turning to a rather disappointing crop for quite a long time, wheat, which has been a real dog in the market, is got around the world winter crops coming along. What are they looking like, and what does that mean for the markets?
Yeah, I should say it's kind of a dog. It's certainly the poor man of the crop market, wheat, just because of these huge stocks that we've got around the world. So we got large stocks, and so you know, you're looking ahead. Is there anything that might happen that would reduce production and start to lower some of these stocks down? And I saw reports on winter wheat in France and Ukraine just this week, and both of them are major producers over there in Europe. And it looks like the crop will be coming out of winter dormancy in good shape there. The winter wheat crop in the U.S. and Kansas and the rest of the southern plains is not in as good a shape as it was last year at this time, although it's not in a really critical situation. It is dry in some areas of the southern plains there in the U.S. Also, it's a lot warmer than usual down there as well, I'm seeing, and the crop is starting to break out of dormancy earlier than usual. Now, if they got some moisture and things stayed warm, that would probably be good for the U.S. winter wheat crop. But it's still pretty early in the year. There's lots of opportunities for severe cold snaps to reach down into the southern plains again. And if that happened, well, then, you know, something that was a big freeze in March or April, that could be very damaging to the crop, because now, you know, if it kind of gets tripped and starts to grow rapidly, then that's the point where frost would be seriously damaging. And as I was thinking about this yesterday, and I was trying to remember, there was a point some years ago where there was quite a bad frost. And I looked it up, and it turns out it was 10 years ago. It was 10 years ago in Easter that a big frost did hit the U.S. winter wheat area down there in Kansas and so on. And certainly supported wheat prices that year. The Americans had in 2006 and 2007 some problems with their winter wheat crop, and there were some other things. Of course, I can't quite remember what they all were, but you might remember that by the end of 2007 and early 2008, that's when wheat prices hit all-time records. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen this year, but there's always we never know what's going to happen with the weather, do we?
And as always, the weather other farmers get sets our prices to a very large extent.
Yeah, exactly. You hope that a disaster hits someplace else and that we manage to get a good crop.
And you just never say that out loud, do we?
No. Well, I guess I just did.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Darce.
You bet, Ed. Thanks very much.
Darce McMillan is the markets editor at The Western Producer. Check out his weekly markets video at producer.com. That's all for this week. I hope you'll join us next week for another edition of Between the Rows. I'm Ed White.
We'd like to thank Gowan Canada, our sponsor for today's Between the Rows podcast. Remember, if you have Group 1 or 2 resistant wild oats on your farm, use Avidex or Fortress to control them. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. If you like what you heard on today's show and you want to hear more, go to membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.